The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hello, I'm your host, Beverly Prentice, and you're listening to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, myth, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
Thank you, Nicholas, for sending me an email and telling me that you liked our program. And just because of that, I found one of the stories you said you enjoyed, The Sound Machine, by Roald Dahl. It was a warm summer evening, and Klausner walked quickly through the front gate and around the side of the house and into the garden at the back. He went on down the garden until he came to a wooden shed, and he unlocked the door, went inside, and closed the door behind him. The interior of the shed was an unpainted room. Against one wall on the left, there was a long wooden workbench, and on it, among a littering of wires and batteries and small sharp tools, there stood a black box about 3 feet long, the shape of a child's coffin. Klausner moved across the room to the box. The top of the box was open, and he bent down and began to poke and peer inside it among a mass of different colored wires and silver tubes. He picked up a piece of paper that lay inside the box, studied it carefully, put it down, peered inside the box, and started running his fingers along the wires, tugging gently at them to test the connections, glancing back at the paper, then into the box, then at the paper again, checking each wire. He did this for perhaps an hour. Then he put a hand around to the front of the box, where there were 3 dials, and he began to twiddle them, watching at the same time the movement of the mechanism inside the box. All the while he kept speaking softly to himself, nodding his head, smiling sometimes, his hands always moving, the fingers moving swiftly, deftly, inside the box, his mouth twisting into curious shapes when a thing was delicate or difficult to do, saying, "Yes, yes. And now this one, yes, yes, but is this right? Is it? Where's my diagram? Ah, yes, of course. Yes, yes, that's right. And now, good, good, yes, 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 yes." His concentration was intense. His movements were quick. There was an air of urgency about the way he worked, of breathlessness, of strong, suppressed excitement. Suddenly he heard footsteps on the gravel path outside, and he straightened and turned swiftly as the door opened and a tall man came in. It was Scott. It was only Scott, the doctor. "Well, well, well," the doctor said, "so this is where you hide yourself in the evenings." "Hello, Scott," Klausner said. "I happened to be passing," the doctor told him, "so I dropped in to see how you were. There was no one in the house, so I came on down here. How's that throat of yours been behaving?" "It's all right. It's fine. Now I'm here, I might as well have a look at it." "Please don't trouble. I'm quite cured. I'm fine." The doctor began to feel the tension in the room. He looked at the black box on the bench. Then he looked at the man. "You've got your hat on," he said. "Oh, have I?" Klausner reached up, removed the hat, and put it on the bench. The doctor came up closer and bent down to look into the box. "What's this?" he said. "Making a radio?" "No, just fooling around." "It's got rather complicated looking innards." "Yes." Klausner seemed tense and distracted. "What is it?" the doctor asked. "It's rather a frightening looking thing, isn't it?" "It's just an idea." "Yes?" "It has to do with sound, that's all." "Good heavens, man, don't you get enough of that sort of thing all day in your work?" "I like sound." "So it seems." The doctor went to the door, turned, and said, "Well, I won't disturb you. Glad your throat's not worrying you anymore." But he kept standing there looking at the box, intrigued by the remarkable complexity of its inside. curious to know what this strange patient of his was up to. "What's it really for?" he asked. "You've made me inquisitive." Klausner looked down at the box, then at the doctor, and he reached up and began gently to scratch the lobe of his right ear. There was a pause. The doctor stood by the door, waiting, smiling. "All right, I'll tell you, if you're interested." There was another pause, and the doctor could see that Klausner was having trouble about how to begin. He was shifting one foot to the other, tugging at the lobe of his ear, looking at his feet. And then at last, slowly, he said, "Well, it's like this. The theory is very simple, really. The human ear, you know, that it can't hear everything. There are sounds that are so low-pitched or so high-pitched that it can't hear them." "Yes," the doctor said, "yes." "Well, speaking very roughly, any note so high that it has more than 15,000 vibrations a second, we can't hear it. Dogs have better ears than us. You know, you can buy a whistle whose note is so high-pitched that you can't hear it at all, but a dog can hear it?" "Yes, I've seen one," the doctor said. "Of course you have. And up the scale, the higher the note of that whistle, there is another note, a vibration, if you like, but I prefer to think of it as a note. You can't hear that one either, and above that there is another and another, rising right up the scale forever and ever and ever, an endless succession of notes, an infinity of notes. There is a note, if only our ears could hear it, so high that it vibrates a million times a second, and another a million times as high as that, and on, higher and higher, as far as numbers go, which is infinity, eternity. Beyond the stars." Klausner was becoming more animated every moment. He was a frail man, nervous and twitchy, with always moving hands. His large head inclined towards his left shoulder as though his neck was not quite strong enough to support it rigidly. His face was smooth and pale, almost white, and the pale gray eyes that blinked and peered from behind a pair of steel spectacles were bewildered, unfocused, remote. He was a frail, nervous, twitchy man, a little man, a moth of a man, dreamy and distracted, suddenly fluttering and animated, and now the doctor looked at that strange pale face and those pale gray eyes, felt that somehow there was about this little person a quality of distance, of immense, immeasurable distance, as though the mind were far away from where the body was. The doctor waited for him to go on. Klausner sighed and clasped his hands tightly together. "I believe," he said, speaking more slowly now, "that there is a whole world of sound about us all the time that we cannot hear. It is possible that up there in those high-pitched, inaudible regions, there is a new, exciting music being made with subtle harmonies and fierce, grinding discords. A music so powerful that it would drive us mad if only our ears were turned to hear the sound of it. There may be anything. For all we know, there may..." "Yes," said the doctor, "but it's not very probable." "Why not? Why not?" Klausner pointed to a fly sitting on a small roll of copper wire on the workbench. "You see that fly? What sort of noise is that fly making now?" "None that one can hear. But for all we know, the creature may be whistling like mad on a very high note, or barking or croaking or singing a song. It's got a mouth, hasn't it? It's got a throat." The doctor looked at the fly and he smiled. He was still standing by the door with his hands on the doorknob. "Well," he said, "so you're going to check up on that." "Some time ago," Klausner said, "I made a simple instrument that provided to me the existence of many odd, inaudible sounds. Often I have sat and watched the needle of my instrument recording the presence of sound vibrations in the air when I myself could hear nothing. And those are the sounds I want to listen to. I want to know where they come from and who or what is making them." "And that machine on the table there," the doctor said, "is that going to allow you to hear these noises?" "It may. Who knows? So far, I've had no luck. But I've made some changes in it. and tonight I'm ready for another trial. This machine, he said, touching it with his hands, is designed to pick up sound vibrations that are too high-pitched for reception by the human ear and to convert them to a scale of audible tones. I tune it in almost like a radio. How do you mean? It isn't complicated. Say I wish to listen to the squeak of a bat. That's a fairly high-pitched sound, about 30,000 vibrations a second. The average human ear can't quite hear it. Now, if there were a bat flying around this room and I turned in to 30,000 on my machine, I would hear the squeaking of that bat very clearly. I would even hear the correct note, F sharp or B flat or whatever it might be, but merely at a much lower pitch. Don't you understand? The doctor looked at the long black coffin box. And you're going to try it tonight? Yes. Well, I wish you luck. He glanced at his watch. My goodness, he said, I must fly. Goodbye, and thank you for telling me. I must call again sometime and find out what happened. The doctor went out and closed the door behind him. For a while longer, Klausner fussed about with the wires in the black box. Then he straightened up and in a soft, excited whisper said, Now we'll try again. We'll take it out into the garden this time, and then perhaps the reception will be better. Lift it up now, carefully. Oh, my God, it's heavy. He carried the box to the door, found that he couldn't open the door without putting it down, carried it back, put it on the bench, opened the door, and then carried it with some difficulty into the garden. He placed the box carefully on a small wooden table that stood on the lawn. He returned to the shed and fetched a pair of earphones. He plugged the wire connections from the earphones into the machine and put the earphones over his ears. The movements of his hands were quick and precise. He was excited and breathed loudly and quickly through his mouth. He kept on talking to himself with little words of comfort and encouragement, as though he were afraid that the machine might not work, and afraid also of what might happen if it did. He stood there in the garden beside the wooden table, so pale, small, and thin that he looked like an ancient, consumptive, bespectacled child. The sun had gone down. There was no wind, no sound at all. From where he stood, he could see over a low fence into the next garden, and there was a woman walking down the garden with the flower basket on her arm. He watched her for a while without thinking about her at all. Then he turned to the box on the table and pressed a switch on its front. He put his left hand on the volume control and his right hand on the knob that moved a needle across a large central dial, like the wavelength dial of a radio. The dial was marked with many numbers in a series of bands starting at 15,000 and going on up to 1,000,000. And now he was bending forward over the machine. His head was cocked to one side in a tense, listening attitude. His right hand was beginning to turn the knob. The needle was traveling slowly across the dial, so slowly he could hardly see it move, and in the earphones he could hear a faint, spasmodic crackling. Behind this crackling sound, he could hear a distant humming tone, which was the noise of the machine itself, but that was all. As he listened, he became conscious of a curious sensation, a feeling that his ears were stretching out away from his head, that each ear was connected to his head by a thin, stiff wire, like a tentacle, and that the wires were lengthening, and that the ears were going up and up, towards a secret and forbidden territory, a dangerous ultrasonic region where ears had never been before and had no right to be. The little needle crept slowly across the dial, and suddenly he heard a shriek, a frightful, piercing shriek, and he jumped and dropped his hands, catching hold of the edge of the table. He stared around him as if expecting to see the person who had shrieked. There was no one in sight except the woman in the garden next door, and it was certainly not she. She was bending down, cutting yellow roses and putting them in her basket. Again it came, a throatless, inhuman shriek, sharp and short, very clear and cold. The note itself possessed a minor metallic quality that he had never heard before. Klausner looked around him, searching instinctively for the source of the noise. The woman next door was the only living thing in sight. He saw her reach down, take a rose stem in the fingers of one hand, and snip the stem with a pair of scissors. Again he heard the scream. It came at the exact moment when the rose stem was cut. At this point, the woman straightened up, put the scissors in the basket with the rose, and turned to walk away. "Mrs. Saunders!" Klausner shouted, his voice shrill with excitement. "Oh, Mrs. Saunders!" And looking around, the woman saw her neighbor standing on his lawn, a fantastic arm-waving little person with a pair of earphones on his head, calling to her in a voice so high and loud that she became alarmed. "Cut another one! Please cut another one, quickly!" She stood still, staring at him. "Why, Mr. Klausner," she said. "What's the matter?" "Please do as I ask," he said. "Cut just one more rose." Mrs. Saunders had always believed her neighbor to be a rather peculiar person. Now it seemed that he had gone completely crazy. She wondered whether she should run into the house and fetch her husband. "No," she thought, "no, he's harmless. I'll just humor him." "Certainly, Mr. Klausner, if you like," she said. She took her scissors from the basket, bent down, and snipped another rose. Again, Klausner heard that frightful, throatless shriek in his earphones. Again, it came at the exact moment the rose stem was cut. He took off the earphones and ran to the fence that separated the two gardens. "All right," he said, "that's enough. No more, please, no more." The woman stood there, a yellow rose in one hand, clippers in the other, looking at him. "I'm going to tell you something, Mrs. Saunders," he said. "Something that you won't believe." He put his hands on top of the fence and peered at her intently through his thick spectacles. "You have, this evening, cut a basket full of roses. You have, with a sharp pair of scissors, cut through the stems of living things, and each rose that you cut screamed in the most terrible way. Did you know that, Mrs. Saunders?" "No," she said, "I certainly didn't know that." "It happens to be true," he said. He was breathing rather rapidly, but he was trying to control his excitement. "I heard them shrieking. Each time you cut one, I heard the cry of pain, a very high-pitched sound, approximately 132,000 vibrations a second. You couldn't possibly have heard it yourself, but I heard it." "Did you really, Mr. Klausner?" She decided she would make a dash for the house in about 5 seconds. "You might say," he went on, "that a rose bush has no nervous system to feel with, no throat to cry with. You'd be right. It hasn't. Not like ours, anyway. But how do you know, Mrs. Saunders?" And here he leaned far over the fence and spoke in a fierce whisper. "How do you know that a rose bush doesn't feel as much pain when someone cuts its stem in two as you would feel if someone cut your wrist off with a garden shears? How do you know that? It's alive, isn't it?" "Yes, Mr. Klausner. Oh, yes. And good night." Quickly she turned and ran up the garden to her house. Klausner went back to the table. He put on the earphones and stood for a while listening. He could still hear the faint crackling sound and the humming noise of the machine, but nothing more. He bent down and took hold of a small white daisy growing on the lawn. He took it between thumb and forefinger and slowly pulled it upward and sideways until the stem broke. From the moment that he started pulling to the moment when the stem broke, he distinctly heard in the earphones a faint, high-pitched cry, curiously inanimate. He took another daisy and did it again. Once more he heard the cry, but he wasn't sure now that it expressed pain. No, it wasn't pain. It was surprise, or was it? It didn't really express any of the feelings or emotions known to a human being. It was just a cry, a neutral, stony cry, a single emotionless note expressing nothing. It had been the same with the roses. He had been wrong in calling it a cry of pain. A flower probably didn't feel pain. It felt something else, which we didn't know about, something called toin or spurl or plinuckmit or anything you like. He stood up and removed the earphones. It was getting dark, and he could see the pricks of light shining in the windows of the houses all around him. Carefully, he picked up the black box from the table, carried it into the shed, and put it on the workbench. Then he went out, locked the door behind him, and walked up to the house. The next morning, Klausner was up as soon as it was light. He dressed and went straight to the shed. He picked up the machine and carried it outside, clasping it to his chest with both hands, walking unsteadily under its weight. He went past the house, out through the front gate, and across the road to the park. There he paused and looked around him. Then he went on until he came to a large tree, a beech tree, and he placed the machine on the ground close to the trunk of the tree. Quickly he went back to the house and got an axe from the coal cellar and carried it across the road into the park. He put the axe on the ground beside the tree. Then he looked around him again, peering nervously through his thick glasses in every direction. There was no one about. It was 6 in the morning. He put the earphones on his head and switched on the machine. He listened for a moment to the faint, familiar humming sound. Then he picked up the axe, took a stance with his legs wide apart, and swung the axe as hard as he could at the base of the tree trunk. The blade cut deep into the wood and stuck there, and at the instant of impact, he heard a most extraordinary noise in the earphones. It was a new noise, unlike any he had heard before. A harsh, noteless, enormous noise, a growling, low-pitched, screaming sound, not quick and short like the noise of the roses, but drawn out like a sob, lasting for fully a minute, loudest at the moment when the axe struck, fading gradually fainter and fainter until it was gone. Klausner stared in horror at the place where the blade of the axe had sunk into the wood flesh of the tree. Then gently he took the axe handle, worked the blade loose, and threw the thing to the ground. With his fingers he touched the gash that the axe had made in the wood, touching the edges of the gash, trying to press them together to close the wound, and he kept saying, "Tree, oh tree, I am sorry, but it will heal fine." For a while he stood there with his hands upon the trunk of the great tree. Then suddenly he turned away and hurried off out of the park, across the road, through the front gate, and back into his house. He went to the telephone, consulted the book, dialed a number, and waited. He held the receiver tightly in his left hand and tapped the table impatiently with his right. He heard the telephone buzzing at the other end, and then the click of a lifted receiver and a man's voice, a sleepy voice, saying, "Oh, yes, Dr. Scott," he said. "Yes, speaking. Dr. Scott, you must come at once. Quickly, please. Who is it speaking?" "Klausner here. And you remember what I told you last night about my experience with sound and how I hoped I might—" "Yes, yes, of course. But what's the matter? Are you ill?" "No, I'm not ill, but—" "It's 6:30 in the morning," the doctor said. "And you call me, but you are not ill? Please come. Come quickly. I want someone to hear it. It's driving me mad. I can't believe it." The doctor heard the frantic, almost hysterical note in the man's voice, the same note he was used to hearing in the voices of people who called up and said, "There's been an accident. Come quickly." He said slowly, "You really want me to get out of bed and come over now?" "Yes, now, at once, please." "All right, then. I'll come." Klausner sat down beside the telephone and waited. He tried to remember what the shriek of the tree had sounded like, but he couldn't. He could remember only that it had been enormous and frightful, and that it had made him feel sick with horror. He tried to imagine what sort of noise a human would make if he had to stand anchored to the ground while someone deliberately swung a small, sharp thing at his leg so that the blade cut it deep and wedged itself in the cut. Some sort of noise, perhaps? No, quite different. The noise of the tree was worse than any known human noise because of that frightening, toneless, throatless quality. He began to wonder about other living things, and he thought immediately of a field of wheat standing up straight and yellow and alive, with the mower going through it, cutting the stems, 500 stems at a time, every second. Oh my God, what would that noise be like? 500 wheat plants screaming together, and every second another 500 being cut and screaming. And no, he thought, I do not want to go to a wheat field with my machine. I would never eat bread after that. But what about potatoes and cabbages and carrots and onions and what about apples? Ah, no, apples are all right. They fall off naturally when they are ripe. Apples are all right if you let them fall off instead of tearing them from the tree branch. But not vegetables, not a potato, for example. A potato would surely shriek. So would a carrot and an onion and a cabbage. He heard the click of the front gate latch, and he jumped up and went out and saw the tall doctor coming down the patch, little black bag in hand. Well, the doctor said, well, what's all the trouble? Come with me, doctor. I want you to hear it. I called you because you're the only one I've told. It's over the road in the park. Will you come now? The doctor looked at him. He seemed calmer now. There was no sign of madness or hysteria. He was merely disturbed and excited. They went across the road into the park, and Klausner led the way to the great beech tree at the foot of which stood the long black coffin box of the machine and the axe. Why did you bring it out here? The doctor asked. I wanted a tree. There aren't any big trees in the garden. And why the axe? You'll see in a moment, but now please put on these earphones and listen. Listen carefully and tell me afterwards precisely what you hear. I want to make quite sure. The doctor smiled and took the earphones and put them over his ears. Klausner bent down and flicked the switch on the panel of the machine. Then he picked up the axe and took his stance with his legs apart, ready to swing. For a moment he paused. Can you hear anything? He said to the doctor. Can I what? Can you hear anything? Just a humming noise. Klausner stood there with the axe in his hands, trying to bring himself to swing, but the thought of the noise that the tree would make him made him pause again. What are you waiting for? The doctor asked. Nothing, Klausner answered, and then lifted the axe and swung it at the tree. And as he swung, he thought he felt, he could swear he felt a movement of the ground on which he stood. He felt a slight shifting of the earth beneath his feet, as though the roots of the tree were moving underneath the soil. But it was too late to check the blow, and the axe blade struck the tree and wedged deep into the wood. At that moment, high overhead, there was the cracking sound of wood splintering and the swishing sound of leaves brushing against other leaves, and they both looked up, and the doctor cried, "Watch out! Run, man! Quickly, run!" The doctor had ripped off the earphones and was running away fast. But Klausner stood spellbound, staring up at the great branch, 60 feet long at least, that was bending slowly downward, breaking and crackling and splintering at its thickest point, where it joined the main trunk of the tree. The branch came crashing down, and Klausner leapt aside just in time. It fell upon the machine and smashed it into pieces. "Great heavens!" shouted the doctor as he came running back. "That was a near one. I thought it had got you." Klausner was staring at the tree. His large head was leaning to one side, and upon his smooth white face there was a tense, horrified expression. Slowly he walked up to the tree, and gently he prized the blade loose from the trunk. "Did you hear it?" he said, turning to the doctor. His voice was barely audible. The doctor was still out of breath from running in the excitement. "Hear what?" "It's the earphones. Did you hear anything when the axe struck?" The doctor began to rub the back of his neck. "Well," he says, "as a matter of fact—" He paused and frowned and bit his lower lip. "No, I'm not sure. I couldn't be sure. I don't suppose I had the earphones on for more than a second after the axe struck." "Yes, yes, but what did you hear?" "I don't know," the doctor said. "I don't know what I heard. Probably the noise of the branch breaking." He was speaking rapidly, rather irritably. "What did it sound like?" Klausner leaned forward slightly, staring hard at the doctor. "Exactly. What did it sound like?" "Oh, hell," the doctor said. "I really don't know. I was more interested in getting out of the way. Let's leave it." "Dr. Scott, what did it sound like? For God's sakes, how could I tell, what with half the tree falling on me and having to run for my life? The doctor certainly seemed nervous. Klausner had sensed it now. He stood quite still, staring at the doctor, and for fully half a minute he didn't speak. The doctor moved his feet, shrugged his shoulders, and half turned to go. "Well," he said, "we'd better get back." "Look," said the little man, and now his smooth white face became suddenly suffused with color. "Look," he said, "you stitched this up." He pointed to the last gash that the axe had made in the tree trunk. "You stitched this up quickly." "Don't be silly," the doctor said. "You do as I say. Stitch it up." Klausner was gripping the axe handle, and he spoke softly in a curious, almost a threatening tone. "Don't be silly," the doctor said. "I can't stitch through wood. Come on, let's get back." "So you can't stitch through wood?" "No, of course not." "Have you got any iodine in your bag?" "What if I have?" "Then paint the cut with iodine. It'll sting, but that can't be helped." "Now look," the doctor said, and again he turned as if to go. "Let's not be ridiculous. Let's get back to the house and then paint the cut with iodine." The doctor hesitated. He saw Klausner's hands tightening on the handle of the axe. He decided that his only alternative was to run away fast, and he certainly wasn't going to do that. "All right," he said, "I'll paint it with iodine." He got his black bag, which was lying on the grass about 10 yards away, opened it, and took out a bottle of iodine and some cotton wool. He went up to the tree trunk, uncorked the bottle, tipped some of the iodine onto the cotton wool, bent down and began to dab it into the cut. He kept one eye on Klausner, who was standing motionless with the axe in his hands, watching him. "Make sure you get it right in." "Yes," the doctor said. "Now do the other one, the one just above it." The doctor did as he was told. "There you are," he said. "It's done." He straightened up and surveyed his work in a very serious manner. "That should do nicely." Klausner came closer and gravely examined the two wounds. "Yes," he said, nodding his huge head slowly up and down. "Yes, that will do nicely." He stepped back a pace. "You'll come and look at them again tomorrow?" "Oh, yes," the doctor said, "of course." "And put some more iodine on?" "If necessary, yes." "Thank you, doctor," Klausner said, and he nodded his head again, and he dropped the axe, and all at once he smiled, a wild, excited smile. And quickly the doctor went over to him, and gently he took him by the arm, and he said, "Come on, we must go now." And suddenly they were walking away, the two of them, walking silently, rather hurriedly, across the park, over the road, back to the house. Tachycardia by Paul Park. I retired from the Corps of Engineers when I was 65. During the afternoons, I'd play golf at Colonial or City Park. I'd have lunch with friends or dinner and a couple of drinks. Then I'd go home to my house on General Pershing Street and turn on the lights. I kept that place as clean as a hotel. After Mary Elizabeth passed away, I took down most of the photographs, cleaned out most of the things. It says in the Bible that death can come at any time. I was on the 17th tee at City Park. I sat down on the grass because I was dizzy and my pulse went to 250. That day I was paired with Bobby Squires, who's a doctor I've known for years. He drove me downtown to his office at University Hospital, the old Hotel Dieu on Tulane Avenue. I hadn't been there since Jeffrey was born. In half an hour, I was on a table in the emergency room, and the technician was putting in a drip. Bobby explained the whole thing as I lay there with a needle in my arm. There is an amino acid called adenosine that stops the heart. After 8 seconds, they switch to saline and start it up again. Usually, that takes care of the problem, which is called tachycardia. But my heart was still roaring even after the procedure, so they decided to try it a second time. I couldn't breathe because of the pressure in my chest, and I passed out. How can I describe what I was feeling? Your heart stops, and everything is still. My wife once read a book that says you hang suspended in the air above your body. I thought that was ridiculous even at the time. I was sitting in the dirt, rubbing my knees and the backs of my hands and then my chest and thighs. It can be painful to grow old by yourself. If you outlive the members of your own family, you've lived too long. Now my heart was quiet, and I didn't breathe. I sat until my eyes were accustomed to the darkness. Smells came to me. Mold, concrete, a trace of urine. The dirt under my hands was clotted with spiderweb, and it seemed to me that I could hear the whining of a mosquito. Now I could see the limits of that place, a concrete box about 10 feet square. The ceiling was low, and I didn't want to stand. Instead, I crawled forward on my hands and knees. There was a gray light that got stronger as I crawled toward it, though it remained indistinct and didn't throw off any kind of shadow. It wasn't until I reached the opening that I understood why. The concrete passage to the outside air was narrow, and it turned back on itself in two 90-degree angles. Squatting on my haunches, looking back toward where I had been sitting, I saw deep horizontal slits in the wall above my head, blocked, I imagined, with vegetation or debris. I could see now where I was, a concrete pillbox or bunker, with walls many feet thick. And though I understood the principle of the entrance, I was not prepared, as I turned the corners, for the brightness of the outside air. As I crawled out into the open, the brightness was like a punch in the nose, and my eyes were watering. As I had had to get used to the darkness, now I got used to the light, which took a longer time. I collapsed onto my knees and forearms and put my head down. I could see that I was wearing my golfing clothes, and my hat was on my head. My shorts and polo shirt had seemed appropriate to a fall day in New Orleans. Abruptly now, I felt like a fool. There were huge, shaggy trees all around me, with roots, like the fine lines of a rocket. There wasn't much undergrowth, and the ground was dry. Through the tree trunks, I could see the ocean. Except for the entrance, the pillbox behind me was obscured with moss and hanging vines, masses of purple flowers. I've spent a good amount of time in the swamps of southeastern Louisiana. We had a camp near Slidwell, but this was not like that. The smells were different, and the bugs, as they lighted on my skin, I didn't recognize them. They didn't cause me any trouble. My golfing shoes were full of ants that didn't bite. I got up and staggered to the shore. Leaning on a tree, its bark as smooth as skin, I shaded my eyes and looked out toward the sun on the water, which was like a mirror. There was a mud cliff that was subsiding into a swamp, and then the open sea beyond. There was no wind. As we get older, it gets easier to summon dreams and images from the past. After a moment, I thought I'd figure it out where I was. My father's older brother had been a captain in the Marines. He'd had a stroke after he'd retired, and when I was a teenager, I used to go visit him in a nursing home in St. Bernard Parish. It was a depressing place, but he'd taken a shine to me, and I'd sit by his bed and listen to him complain about that Douglas MacArthur, as he called him. He'd tell me stories about New Guinea. I knew about the Japanese defenses, the mangrove swamp where my uncle's unit had been pinned down. It was a day in hell, he said. All that was long ago. The place was empty now. After a few minutes, I turned away from the shore and followed a path through the bushes. When my son Jeffrey was a little boy, on weekends I used to take him down to Audubon Park. Right by the zoo, there is a stand of oak trees, and we used to play a game. He would toddle off into the undergrowth, and I would count for a minute and come after him. Usually, I'd find him hiding about 20 feet away in some obvious place, or else standing in plain sight. But one day he disappeared, and after a few minutes of searching, I was yelling as hard as I could. I assumed he really was hiding from me, even after I told him the game was over. But what had happened was that he had fallen into a hole where someone had buried some illegal trash. He was up to his waist in the debris, and though I had passed within a few feet of him, he had been too frightened to cry out. What is it that brings certain memories suddenly to mind? My son, his eyes were a color I've never seen before, a gray so clear that it was disconcerting. Maybe the image of his face is never far away from me. That day my threats had not consoled him. Terrified, I yanked him out, and his leg caught on a piece of metal. He had to get a tetanus shot. Why do certain images come to us, whole and complete, as if out of the air? Is there always a reason? Maybe this was my train of thought. There were some sounds from jungle animals I couldn't see. Maybe there were some monkeys crying on the other side of the fence, which separate the park from the zoo. Now, as I took the path away from the shore, I thought about the animals my uncle had told me about, the ones he had seen in the camp near Buna in New Guinea, or else heard crying in the darkness. Why are they so frightening, the dangers we cannot see? In my son's face, even up to the last days, I could not guess what he would do. Though I could hear the noises, I myself could make no sound. When I stumbled at the bottom of a small ravine, I opened my mouth and no sound came out. My hat was gone, and I lay on my back at the bottom of the ditch. And when my eyes had cleared, I saw that I was looking up at a human face, a black man. I've always been a prejudiced person, but I was happy to see these fellows. There were several of them. The sunlight was behind their heads. It slanted through the tall trees. Then I felt them help me to my feet, and they were pushing me through the long leaves, and I could feel the pain in my chest. Then they laid me down and left me, and I turned onto my side, and I could see Jeffrey, my son. He was about 20 feet away. He was standing inside a bamboo cage, dug into the slope, so that only the top third of it rose above the surface of the ground. I lay in a kind of dell that had been cut into the raw earth. I lay on wood chips, and near me was a campfire. I rose to my knees and tried to speak, but no sound came out. Jeffrey, I tried to say. He wasn't looking at me. He was staring through the bars of his cage, his arms as thin as the sticks of a bamboo, as they had been toward the end. Surely he'd been mistreated. The fire was smoking. On a stump near the fire lay an army helmet, covered with netting and leaves. Who had done this to him? What enemy had attacked us? I tried to speak, but could not. Jeffrey stared listlessly away. There was a pain in my chest. Still, I managed to crawl forward and reach out my hand. Jeff, I tried to say. But then there were some explosions that shook the ground, and I dropped down into the dirt. When I opened my eyes again, I was lying on my back on the table in the emergency room, the needle in my arm. My heart was beating at a normal rate. Sheesh, said Bobby Squires. I thought we'd lost you. You were gone for over 2 minutes. They had to use the paddles. I need more time, I said, which he misunderstood. This was after they had brought me upstairs to his office to recuperate. I was in a wheelchair, though I felt fine. Bobby was going over my prognosis and telling me to quit drinking and the little cigars I smoke. I'd heard it all before. I take medication for high blood pressure and high cholesterol, and he was telling me about that. He wanted to keep me overnight in the hospital for observations and tests, but I said no. I wanted to get home. Later, I sat on the back porch of the house on General Pershing Street, drinking an old-fashioned. My wife used to make them for me, but she'd left the recipe, and to tell the truth, they tasted better now. This was the house we'd moved to when Jeffrey was about 6. He'd gone to school around the corner. Looking out over the backyard, I could picture him playing in the dirt between the chain-link fence and the gardenias. Everything had been fine for a long time. I was working hard to put food on the table. I'd have to go up to Baton Rouge. So then he went away to Grinnell College, which is not what I'd wanted for him. He had excelled in high school, and I guess he expected to excel there, too. That was in the late 60s. He had what you might call a nervous breakdown, although I never called it that. But it was enough for his deferment. And after that, he came home to live. I admit, I was unsympathetic. He was my only child. I wanted what was best. Looking back, knowing myself, it's hard to imagine what I'd do differently nowadays. Of course, you can cure any of those mental problems with a few pills. A few days after this experience with my heart, I went out to the camp north of Slidell in the Honey Island Swamp. I hadn't been there for almost 30 years since Jeffrey's death. It had been an important place to him and me. Now, after my experience at the hospital, for the first time I came to understand why the pictures in my mind had been so vivid as my uncle told his stories about New Guinea. There was a stretch of shore near the cabin. I could see it now. For a long time it had been hidden from me by some trick of the mind. Instead of cypress, I had put in mangrove trees. I had made a steeper slope above the beach. And of course I had put in a whole ocean, the Solomon Sea, I guess, instead of the wide brackish waters of the river. But the shape of the land was the same. Only the scale had changed. Perhaps when my uncle described the place to me, he had allowed the image of that shore to supplement his memory. He also knew the place well. Whatever the reason, as I came in over the old road, I thought about what I would find. I parked the caddy at the turnaround, then got out and leaned against the hood for a while. It was evening time, after a clear, dry day. There were some lights at the neighbor's house where Mrs. Douglas lived year-round. Some cousins of mine still used the camp on weekends. I walked down the dirt path and then onto the bridge. The cabin was built on stilts over the water, a one-room, tin-roofed shack with a dock on three sides. There'd been some new work on the place, and it had been painted green, though not recently. There was a padlock on the door. I couldn't see anything through the windows, just some boxy shadows, though the table was the same. No one knew I was coming. Most of that part of the family I hadn't spoken to in years. The water was low. I lit a Dutch Masters to keep the bugs away and sat out on the deck, dangling my feet, looking back toward shore. There was a new boathouse in the trees. After a while, I unwrapped a pint of bourbon, which I had mixed in the bottle with some of that old-fashioned syrup. I wasn't taking any of my medications, but even so, the doctors had warned me how it could be years before I had another episode of tachycardia. I could die first, which didn't interest me. The water lay black and flat to Honey Island. It sucked at the pilings. I finished the cigar, then walked across the bridge, around past the new boathouse, down the slope onto the strand. It was an odd feeling, a place I knew well, except I hadn't been there in over 25 years. Weeks together on my childhood, long weekends with Jeffrey or alone, then nothing. The shape of the shore was just as I remembered it, the creak of the dry mud underfoot. I walked toward the fallen cypress where they had found the body. It had washed among the cypress knees under some bushes that overhung the water. No current to speak of. A dry November night like this one. He had been drinking, they said. Mary Elizabeth was with me, and when we were driving back to the city from Slidell, suddenly we hit a squall over the lake. The streetlights and the raindrops on the windshield made a pattern on my wife's face. I have had good luck in several aspects of my life. The worst things are not failures, but what can't be helped. My wife was religious at one time, which was no consolation, even though her priest was a reasonable man. The teachings of the church are clear. It is a sign of God's love to be able to help others. We would have done anything. Jeffrey had gone up to the cabin for the weekend to think things over after I blew up at him and told him he couldn't live with us anymore. He had to get out on his own. The police said his death was accidental, which I didn't believe, and neither did Mary Elizabeth. That's what ate her up. Now I stood on the same shore where he had stood. Next time, I thought, I would not be unprepared or empty-handed. I would do my duty as a father and a husband. But of course, I had a long time to wait. It wasn't until June that I experienced my second episode of tachycardia. I had been drinking some and my blood pressure was high. "You look terrible," said Bobby Squires. It was the first time I had seen him in months. "Just a little more time," I said. When he finally understood what I was asking, he shook his head. "Are you crazy? We're not going through that again." He didn't have a choice. I passed out in his office, and when I woke up, I was lying in the darkness on a concrete floor. There was a smell of varnish in the air, and I knew where I was. There was a pirogue on sawhorses, a line of brilliant lights under the door. As before, everything was still. I lay on my stomach for a moment, but I had no time to waste. I was afraid the boathouse was padlocked on the outside. Then I put my hand against the door, and it swung open. The light was so sudden it brought tears to my eyes. The grade was steep, and I pitched downhill onto the strand. The sun was bright on the water. It was the middle of the day. I was afraid to raise my eyes and look. I studied the tassels of my loafers until I couldn't bear it any longer, and then I looked up. He was there, half submerged under a cage of branches among the cypress knees. At first, I thought he was just floating on the current, but then I saw him move his hand. I saw his head come up, his bony neck and long wet hair. "Jeff," I said, and I could hear my voice. I felt in my pocket for my wife's pruning shears, which I had brought with me, along with several other tools. As I got close, I could see Jeffrey was caught. Something had him by the leg. I waded into the water and saw that his pant leg was caught on a submerged log, and he was yanking at it occasionally, trying to free himself. There was no urgency to any of his movements. Most of his torso was above water. He was lying in among the roots of a submerged tree. He had on one of those colored shirts I used to hate. It's funny how you forget. Was this really how it had happened? He had just flopped around like a fish until he died? It was pitiful. The tide never ran more than a few inches here. Sure, he was drunk, but that was no excuse. I saw his bony face with his cheek next to the water, his lank brown hair. He had been a strong boy, an athlete at Jesuit. But as he lost weight these last 2 years, his mother's weakness had come out in his face, her fine bones. His skin was paler than mine, dusted with red freckles. He'd gotten too much sun. It was a hot day. He was pretty well caught. There was a hole in his jeans and the cloth had twisted itself around a jutting stub of a branch. The water was dirty and full of weeds. I worked at the wet denim with the garden shears until it gave way. All the time, Jeffrey was looking at me stupidly. Like his mother, he was myopic, and his glasses had come off. It took him a while to figure out who I was. Then he was angry, and he tried to pull away. "Shut up," I said, as I was dragging him out of the water. "Enough of this crap. I'm taking you home." He hadn't shaved. He smelled of whiskey in the swamp. I pulled him up by the collar of his shirt. He was 23 years old and like a child. "Your mother will be worried stiff," I said. "Leave me alone." I wasn't having any of that. I pulled him toward the cabin. "Let me go. I can take care of myself," he said, which was ridiculous. I didn't have to answer. I didn't have to be his friend, but I wanted to get him away from the place where he had died. I kept in mind the beach from my uncle's story, the camp deserted only for a moment. The camouflaged helmet on the stump. Jeff was filthy and he stank. "Come on," I said, "let's get cleaned up. You must be thirsty," I said. He was very frail. I put my hand around his upper arm and led him up the slope. There was an empty bottle in the mud. "Where are my glasses?" he said, and I picked them up. But I wouldn't let go of his arm until I had brought him up the slope past where the boathouse had been and over the bridge to the cabin. It was the same weathered gray that I remembered, and the deck was broken and along one side. The screen door was ripped, and behind it, the door stood open. There was Jeffrey's old rucksack on the bed, and clothes strewn around, and dirty dishes in the sink. "Let's clean you up and get you into some dry things," I said. All that had happened between us. I know it was my fault. Mary Elizabeth used to tell me I had worked too hard when he was young. She didn't say so at the time. This much is true. The problems we had, I didn't see them coming. Now I poured out some water from one of the 10-gallon jerry cans into a pot in the metal sink. He wiped his face with the dishcloth while I looked at the calendar for 1973. It was from a car dealership off Chef Metier. Beside the stovepipe, thumbtacked to the wall, was a grocery list in my handwriting. Jeffrey was quiet, and I turned my back to let him peel off his shirt. "You are a son of a bitch," he said finally. I glanced at him, then looked into his gray eyes. Clean-shaven with a haircut and some meat on his bones, he would have been a fine boy. Although my heart was quiet, still I had an ache in my chest. The truth was, the whole time he was a kid, we'd gotten along fine. There hadn't been a lot of talking, which was just as well. You can never figure things out just by talking. We'd gone to Pelican games on Saturday afternoons and never said a word. Later, I taught him how to catch a fish, how to drive a car. I hoped someday he'd remembered some of those things. It didn't matter now, and there was no reason for me to get angry. In the back of my mind, I knew we were in danger. There was no time for him to speak before I smelled the fire. Someone had lit the deck on fire, torched the bridge. I tried to go out, but the heat was intense. It was unnatural the way the whole thing went up. The deck surrounded the house on three sides, and I stepped between the bed and the table to the window at the back, which looked straight down over the water. I broke the screen out of the frame and called out to Jeffrey, who was rummaging through the rucksack on the bed. The fire was bursting through the planks over the sink. The calendar curled up, dropped off the wall, and Jeffrey wasn't moving. He had his rucksack in his hand, and he was looking toward the open door, which was full of the roaring flame. I grabbed his wrist. The heat was intolerable, and I couldn't be gentle. I climbed over the sill and bundled him down into the water, which was about 5 feet below the sill and about 5 feet deep. He wasn't resisting me. He followed me down, and then I pulled him into deeper water because I was afraid some of the beams of the house would fall. Then we paddled a little way downstream where we could touch the bottom of it as it rose on a shoal of mud 30 feet from the bank. The heat was on our faces as we squatted down to watch the burning house and also the woods behind it catching fire and the fire moving up and down the shore along the dry ground. There was fire on the other side of the river, too, and the sky darkened. Clouds came in and a stiff wind, and it was dark except for the fire along the bank. There was all manner of scrub trees, but the treetops were dark and tree trunks silhouetted by the flames, because the fire seemed to burn only low along the ground, so it got dark. The beams of the cabin collapsed into the water in a gust of sparks. The water was cold. I put my arm around Jeffrey's shoulder and was surprised to find him heavier and more solid. He held on to my arm, and I could feel him being pulled away, as if there was something in the water that was holding on to him. I didn't have the garden shears anymore, but I had my sheath knife attached to my belt, and I pulled it out and hacked at the water while Jeffrey clung to my neck. All this time, the wind was coming up, and there were waves on the river. The clouds were ripped to pieces overhead. I took hold of Jeffrey around the waist and brought him over the shoals onto the bank. The mud sucked at my shoes. The rain came toward us over the water, and it covered the fire and put it out, and we had to take shelter in the trees. Around us was the crash of breaking branches. I put my forearm over my eyes and then took Jeffrey by the hand. He followed like a boy, and I led him up the slope and through the smoking woods to my old caddy, not the hunk of junk I own now. This one was solid as a tank, which was a good thing. I pushed a fallen branch off the roof, opened the door, and Jeff slid across the seat, and we were safe. Keys were in the ignition, The caddy started up. Then we were driving through the dark, and after a while, the rain stopped.